Nightly News, CBS, ABC, as well as PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And on those four nightly newscasts, in the week before and after Colin Powell gave his push for war at the United Nations, February 5th, 2003, just weeks before the U.S. invaded Iraq, in those two crucial weeks, there were 393 interviews done around war. Only three were with anti-war representatives. Three of almost 400. That is no longer a mainstream media. In fact, most of the people in the country at the time were opposed to the invasion. They were for more inspections and diplomacy. That's an extreme media that, as Noam Chomsky says, beats the drums for war, icing out dissent. You know, in the last few weeks, watching the coverage of the case of Terry Schiavo, that very unfortunate situation, it was astounding. 2 weeks of wall-to-wall coverage, around the clock. The protesters would go to the microphone outside the hospice in Florida, not talking about the family, but the protesters, this small group, several dozen. And the networks would cut away, live. Almost every time they went to that microphone. Now, this was not a group that represented most people in the United States. In fact, it was astounding to see the polls. More than 80 to 90% of the people in this country were opposed to congressional intervention, opposed to President Bush signing off on this legislation, even the majority of evangelicals opposed to what was taking place. And yet the media constantly went to those protesters. MSNBC's Hardball invited me on to talk about this coverage and asked what I thought, and I said, let it be a model for the coverage of all protest in this country. Because think about what happened 2 weeks before. That was March 19th. That was the second anniversary of the invasion. There were more than 800 protests in this country. Tens of thousands of people marched, they vigiled, they rallied. Down in Fayetteville, North Carolina, the families who lost loved ones in Iraq, soldiers who were refusing to return to Iraq, they were all speaking up. Here in Central Park, thousands gathered. One of those who spoke was Javier Cosso. His brother, Jose Cosso, died in the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad 2 years ago on April 8th, 2003, the day before the Marines pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein. He was the Spanish cameraman who worked for Telecinco television in Spain. He was on the 14th floor on the balcony filming U.S. military actions. They had a very good view of Baghdad, as were some other camera people. And the U.S. military opened fire, killing Jose Cosso, and the Reuters cameraman as well, Taras Prostia. It seemed to be a killing spree that day because earlier in the day, over at the Al Jazeera offices, Tariq Ayoub, a young Jordanian-Palestinian journalist who just come to cover Iraq for Al Jazeera, had gone up on the roof with his cameraman to fix the camera angle. And he died too when the U.S. military attacked the area and then went on to Abu Dhabi TV to take out the camera positions on the roofs there. Tariq Ayoub, Taras Prostia, Jose Cosso, bringing us the images of war that we don't see in this country, that we don't hear in this country, and then the drumbeat of an administration that says to dissent is to be with the enemy. To dissent is to protect this country. That's what makes it healthy. That's why we're having this meeting tonight, to hear people speaking for themselves. not hearing that small group of pundits that we watch on all the networks who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us, but hearing different perspectives, people sharing their views. That's what America should be about. And it is especially important in a time when in this country we're seeing a very serious crackdown. And that's what is so frightening, and that's what threatens us all. We have an administration that demonizes whole populations, well, always African Americans, but now Arab Americans, Muslims, people of South Asian descent. It is so important that we all stand up together. I didn't say agree with each other, but stand up together, because it makes it that much harder to target any individual. Because when individuals, when whole populations are targeted, that's when we are all in danger. And so we'll move on to the speakers tonight. We're going to turn first to Monique Dalls, a Columbia University student in the School of General Studies and a member of the Campus Anti-War Network. She's been active in the campaign to stop McCarthyism at Columbia and in Palestine solidarity work. Her writings appeared in Socialist Worker, Counterpunch, ZNet, and Electronic Intifada. She's also a member of the International Socialist Organization. Monique Dalls.
Really appreciate being able to sit on this panel with Tariq Ali, who I've spoken with. And I'm going to speak directly to my experiences at Columbia University. Some of you may have heard some about the intense crackdown that's been happening at Columbia recently, but if you haven't, just to give you a little bit of background, last semester there was a film that was produced by a number of pro-Israel students on campus with the support of an outside pro-Israel group called the David Project, and this film brought together a number of accusations from students who claimed that they were intimidated in the classroom by a number of Middle Eastern professors. They made this film, they called it a documentary, they screened it with upper-level administrators, with press, and what the film really amounted to was a series of unsubstantiated allegations mixed up with stories of anti-Semitism that was picked up by the media, in particular by the right-wing media, and created a firestorm of debate around the Middle Eastern Studies Department at Columbia. Now, what's important to point out is that the students who put forward these allegations claim to be working on behalf of students' rights and on behalf of academic freedom, but their project was funded by an organization called the David Project, which came into being in 2002, in the spring of 2002. What happened in the spring of 2002? Well, in the spring of 2002, a pro-Palestine movement emerged on campuses around this country. A divestment movement emerged on the campuses around this country. This is when Jenin, the massacres at Jenin, this is when the IDF launched an incursion into the West Bank in Gaza. And the David Project was created to counter the progress of this movement that explicitly came into being to narrow the terms of the discussion on campuses. The David Project is not an organization that fights fearlessly for academic freedom or student rights around the country, but simply put, goes from campus to campus, actively aiming to marginalize the pro-Palestinian view on campus, and even helped to defund an Islamic study chair at one university. Now, in the midst of all this, President Bollinger, he set up a panel of an investigative panel of professors to look into these allegations. And what this did was it set a bad precedent. It set a precedent that said, if you are politically in disagreement with your professors, that you could get the media, you can get these outside politically motivated right-wing organizations on your side, and you could get your professors hung out to dry by the administration. Now, the findings of this investigation found that there was no anti-Semitism systematically at Columbia University, that there's no systematic intimidation of students. And anyone could have seen this months ago, years ago. But what the report did was that it isolated a few incidences that they claimed were credible. And in particular, it isolated Professor Massad, who's speaking with us tonight, and it scapegoated him. It said, yes, maybe he did go a little bit too far. But what no one will talk about, is that Professor Massad has been the target of a systematic attack at Columbia University for the past several years. No one will talk about the spy rings in his classroom, where auditors come into the classroom and interrupt and disrupt the class and circulate petitions to get him fired simply because he stands up and is a fearless defender of the rights of Palestinians to return to their land and not to live in ghettoized conditions. So I'm just going to speak quickly about one example that I can recall in the spring of 2001 when I took Professor Massad's class on the Israeli-Palestinian politics and cultures class. It was the first time that I was introduced to such a depth of criticisms of both Israel's claim to the land and also of Palestinian nationalism. Like many people who grew up in this country, I was led to believe that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was simply an age-old ethnic rivalry, that it simply, was too complicated to understand. And certainly impossible to resolve. But this class broke through that for me and introduced me to a range of debate that I had never heard before on the issue. But there's one particular incident that stands out in my mind that I think is worth telling. I took that class with one of the most outspoken pro-Israel students at Columbia who just recently graduated, named Noah Lieben. He's featured in this film, Columbia Unbecoming, that I referenced earlier, produced by the David Project. And in this film, he claims that Massad disrespected and humiliated him in the class. But this couldn't be farther from the truth. One day, during a lecture on Israel's racism against non-European, Asian, and African Jews, Noah Lieben defended these practices. He claimed that the Ashkenazi, or European Jews, played a civilizing role in the lives of non-white Jews in Israel. He claimed that these Jews lacked Jewish culture, and that they needed to be modernized and cultured by the Ashkenazi Jews. This defense of the white man's burden caused the entire class to gasp in outrage. And many even laughed at Lieben's outright contempt for the culture of non-European Jews. In other words, Lieben humiliated himself in class with his own defense of the civilizing project of colonialism, as well as his own defense of Israel's racist policies. But this is what's at stake today. In some small enclaves in the university, there still exist some places where anti-colonialism and anti-racism are the starting point. The fact that a racist comment would be met with awe and disgust from fellow students is a threat to the entire project today of empire building. And they want to change this. At a moment when the entire framework of the white man's burden is being resurrected to justify a war in Iraq, a war on the Palestinian people, and a broader war on terror throughout the world, it is only natural that they would attack anyone who resists this. Now, judging by the current state of politics in this country today, it's pretty clear that they have plenty of mechanisms in place to control the political sphere, the terms, and the breadth of political debate in this country. But it is a prerequisite today to sit in the White House that you be tough on terror. There is a consensus in Washington to support Israel's brutal occupation and relentlessly crush the Iraqis' determination to run their own country. This entire project is predicated on lies about weapons of mass destruction and excuses of democratization and humanitarianism. But it's the professors and the scholars who have come under attack. They're the ones that are coming under attack for shooting holes in these arguments and exposing them. Professor Massad's class is a perfect example. because he always allowed for people who disagreed with him to voice those opinions and raise questions and create debate. He was able to show how those arguments fall apart in the face of scrutiny, historic facts, and real debate. And these are the kinds of people that are coming under attack today. This is what Washington and Tel Aviv are afraid of, a real debate which allows people to make up their own mind when confronted with the realities of occupation and dispossession. And today they want to reach into and regulate the terms of the debate in the university and narrow the range of debate and scholarship to what is considered acceptable, narrow that to what is considered acceptable by the needs of empire. But this isn't new. In April 1965, Students for a Democratic Society, they called their first national demonstration against the war in Vietnam. They expected a couple thousand people, but 20,000 people, mostly students, came out. And the president of SDS at the time, he made a speech that I want to quote from quickly. He said, most of us grew up thinking that the United States was a strong but humble nation that respected the integrity of other nations and other systems, and that engaged in wars only as a last resort. If at some point we began to hear vague and disturbing things about what this country had done in Latin America, China, Spain, and other places, we remained somehow confident about the basic integrity of this nation's foreign policy. He continues, the incredible war in Vietnam has provided the razor, the terrifying sharp cutting edge that has finally severed the last vestige of illusion that morality and democracy are the guiding principles of American foreign policy. The further we explore the reality of what this country is doing and planning in Vietnam, the more we are driven towards the conclusion that the U.S. may well be the greatest threat to peace in the world today. And so much of that is true today. But today, we can begin to see the beginning stages of this process, but we have our own political challenges. SDS broke through the stalemate of McCarthyism and the Cold War era by rejecting the very logic of anti-communism, and this strengthened their ability to more effectively counter the war in Vietnam. Today, we need to reject the racist logic that is coming out of Washington, the racist logic of the war on terror, which has thousands of Arabs locked up in detention centers, tortured, and disappeared. We have to reject this logic because it is the driving force for the U.S.'s destruction and occupation of Iraq, and it is the driving force behind the new McCarthyism and the new blacklist today. This racism, it's not a coincidence that the professors who have come under the most vitriolic attacks are Middle Eastern. The problem with the campaign from the right, from these students, is that they claim students' rights. They claim intimidation. But if we're going to talk about real issues of students' rights, we're going to talk about cases, real cases of racism that happened at Columbia University last year against African-American students that were swept under the rug by the administration. We're going to talk about the graduate student unionization drive that the university is doing everything in its power to undermine. If we're going to talk about real students' rights, we also need to talk about professors' rights. We need to talk about what real justice would look like. In no case should it be considered okay that a Middle Eastern professor today face the racist characterization that he or she is waging jihad in the classroom, or that he or she is a terrorist sympathizer, which is one of the characterizations that Professor Massad and many others have faced. In no case should we stand by while this happens, and we have to call this out for what it is. It's simply straight up racism. Professors should be able to structure their class however they want. They should be able to put anyone on the syllabus that can actually expose the reality of what it means to be a Palestinian, of what it means to be an Iraqi living under U.S. bombs. And that's what they're there for, and that's their job, and we need to stand up against these racist characterizations. I'm just going to close by letting people know about the campaign to stop McCarthyism at Columbia, because it's come a long way, and I've been really excited to be working with a number of people that have gotten involved. Right now, the campaign is working on putting out a newsletter, a pamphlet that can actually bring together the criticism and expose the role that the Columbia University administration has played in actively persecuting these professors and actively scapegoating them and hanging them out to dry. And we are wrapping up this semester, but we're going to continue this into the future because it's not going to end here as much as the university would like us to think. There's a table set up outside. People can go by. We are not only Columbia students, and we desperately need the support of people here in this room. We desperately need the support of the, you know, million people who came out to oppose the war, because what we're seeing now is a new level and a new level of the war.
Joseph Massad teaches modern era politics and intellectual history at Columbia University. He's author of the book Colonial Effects, The Making of National Identity in Jordan. It was published in 2001 by Columbia University Press. Desiring Arabs, forthcoming from Harvard University Press. And The Persistence of the Palestinian Question, forthcoming from Routledge. Professor Massad is author of numerous scholarly articles about Zionism and Palestinian nationalism. He's also a columnist for the Egyptian newspaper Al-Haram Weekly.
Thank you very much. Destroying the university is the latest goal of right-wing forces who have hijacked not only political power and political discourse in this country, but also the very vocabulary that can be used against them. We live in an atmosphere of siege where destroying academic freedom is identified by right-wing forces as defending academic freedom. The intimidation and silencing of professors by students and spies sponsored by off-campus organizations and the right-wing press is identified as intimidation by professors. Facile ideological positions are identified as scholarship, while scholarship is delegitimized as ideology. The campaign of the last 3 years or so to attack the universities as the last bastion where a measure of freedom of thought is still protected is engineered to cancel out such freedom and ensure that scholars will not subvert the received political wisdom of the day. Some of the major tactics in this campaign have been the launching of witch hunts against specific professors, calling for their dismissal from their jobs, and failing that, smear the reputation. Target Middle East studies as a scholarly field more generally, and cut federal funding to it, and place it under governmental supervision. And promote apologists for Israel in the guise of scholars as the only adequate scholarly alternative. While shutting down the educational process in favor of religious theories of creationism and the like has been around for a while, the recent attack on scholars who disagree with U.S. foreign policy and the policies of the State of Israel are the main mobilizational issues of the current campaign. While academic freedom is what is at stake in this assault, scholarship, and specifically scholarship on Palestine and Israel, is the primary target of the witch hunters. What makes these anti-scholarship attacks relatively easy is the existence of a major discrepancy, even a radical disconnect, between popular knowledge and media coverage about the Palestine-Israel conundrum and established scholarly knowledge about the topic. It is this disconnect that the witch hunters mobilize against scholarship as proof that it is not as proof that it is not media and popular knowledge that defends Israeli policy and Zionism's political axioms that are ideological, but rather academic scholarship, which has largely uncovered unsavory facts about both. Thus, when young students who come from ideologically charged homes, schools, and environments attend university classes, they mistake established scholarship as pro-Palestinian propaganda. A conclusion that is propped up by the likes of Campus Watch, the David Project, and the ADL, all three organizations who make it part or all their business to attack scholarly criticisms of Israeli policy. Let me give you a few examples of what I'm talking about. All respected scholars in the field agree that most or all Palestinians who became refugees in 1948 were expelled by Israel. The debate that exists is about whether all Palestinian refugees were physically expelled by the Israeli army, or that the Israeli army expelled the majority, while a minority of refugees fled not as a direct result of physical force, but as an indirect consequence of actions by the Israeli army and government, which might or might not be, or might not have been deliberately intended to expel them. In contrast, media and popular ideological knowledge in the U.S. still insists that the Palestinians fled on their own and that the Zionists begged them to stay. Established scholarship enumerates all the racist laws and institutional racist practices in operation in Israel, which discriminate between Jews and non-Jews, granting Jews differential rights and privileges over non-Jews, rendering Israel a racist state by law. Popular and media knowledge, in contrast, depict Israel as a democratic liberal state that treats all its citizens equally. It is established in scholarship that Israel discriminates against non-European Jews and has engaged and continues to engage in a racist discourse and in unofficial institutional discrimination against them. In contrast, popular and media knowledge depicts Israel as a place where all Jews are equal. Scholarly knowledge addresses the question of Israel as a theological state where religious law governs major aspects of Jewish life, and that only Orthodox Judaism is allowed to have religious authority over Jewish citizens to the exclusion of Reform and Conservative Judaism, let alone other Jewish denominations. In contrast, media and popular knowledge depict Israel as a secular state. These are only a few examples of how scholarly knowledge is drastically different from and opposed to media and popular knowledge about key issues regarding Israeli society and history. Israel's apologists and right-wing witch hunters aim to establish this popular and media knowledge, which echo the official positions of the State of Israel and those of its U.S. lobby, as scholarly and dismiss academic scholarship as ideology. It is in this context that many of the organizations and individuals attacking me are under the false impression that what I teach in my classes is a Palestinian perspective or narrative. In fact, I do no such thing. In my class on the topic, I teach academic scholarship on Palestine and Israel, which is precisely why the witch hunters want Colombia to fire me. The campaign against me began soon after 9/11. While initially it would include registered students who would interrupt my class regularly, insist on reading from pro-Israel propaganda tracts in the middle of the lecture, demand that I provide chapter and verse documentation for whatever I am lecturing about, even though their course readings offered all the necessary documentation, it would soon expand. While I allowed all questions to be asked during my lectures, even though there were discussion sections for the course, this was not sufficient. Students with political agendas began to bring unannounced, unregistered guests with them to class to observe me and to ask questions. Soon, one student began to circulate a petition to get me fired on the recommendation of people from outside the university, while another took part in a secret meeting convened by a female professor at the medical school, which was so eerie that it felt to him that they were planning to have me, and I quote him, murdered, unquote, when in fact they were strategizing to get me fired. In the meantime, student activists at the university who were not in my class began to publish articles attacking my public lectures outside the classroom, accusing me of anti-Semitism. They were joined soon by two major pro-Israel propagandists, Daniel Pipes and Martin Kramer, who after failing in U.S. academia, excelled as thought policemen. Pipes identified me as an extremist on campus, listed me on his Campus Watch website with my own public dossier, and began to rail against me in columns and right-wing newspapers like the New York Post. Kramer would claim that my students were complaining to him about my bias in the classroom and began to call on Columbia to fire me. The campaign would get strengthened when the New York Sun joined the ranks with editorials and defamatory articles about me. They would comment on everything I wrote in newspapers and more recently in scholarly journals. The Anti-Defamation League wrote me a letter, which they copied to the Columbia administration, calling me an anti-Semite based on a lecture I gave at the University of Pennsylvania, as reported to them by one student. If this was not enough, the campaign also took an international dimension. Threats to a lecture I was giving at Oxford University drove Oxford to provide me with 5 security officers to protect me when I gave it. The Israeli press, including Haaretz, would publish articles about my lectures based on hearsay and without having a correspondent present. Rabbi Shear of the Campus Hillel organization effectively called on students not to take my class and announced that a video was being made. President Bollinger of Colombia convened a secret committee to look into the allegations of intimidation, which found no evidence of bias or intimidation, even though they heard the testimonies, which would soon be included in the propaganda film Colombia Unbecoming. This well-orchestrated campaign preceded the David Project's spearheading of the more recent witch hunt through its propaganda film. Once the film was made, it was secretly shown to the Colombia administration. Acting Vice President Ira Katzenelson agreed to see the propaganda film and not to issue a statement about it. One wonders how many members of the Colombia administration would accept to meet with an Arab propaganda lobbying group and watch a propaganda film about alleged intimidation of Arab students at Colombia by Jewish and Christian professors. In Arabic, there's a saying which aptly describes the whole affair. We say, he beat me up and cried and then raced me to the judge to complain. But I digress. Soon the film would leak to the media and the omniscient New York Sun would break the story in October, 4 months after it was first shown to members of the Columbia administration. Not only does the university administration fail to defend its own university and its own faculty, it begins to implicate both as guilty through defensive and unclear public statements, innuendo, and ultimately through open assumption that Columbia and its faculty were guilty of not addressing legitimate student grievances, all with no corroborating evidence. The same day the story broke out, I received an email from one Moshe Rubin, a professor in the medical school, calling me, and I quote, a typical Arab liar, and then demanding that I get out of America. As the campaign heats up, a congressman calls on Columbia to fire me, and members of the New York City Council call for an investigation. The New York Sun and the Daily News soon issue editorial calls to have me fired. The witch hunt would expand to the Israeli press. The film, which remains a guarded secret, shown to select audiences, is taken to Israel and shown to government ministers who issue statements about the alleged rampant antisemitism at Columbia. The film itself is said to have been edited 6 times since the first showing. It functions as a moving target and is closely guarded from open public scrutiny. Alan Dershowitz wrote a letter to the Times advising Columbia on how to investigate me and then came in person to deliver lectures on campus of how I and other professors at Columbia encourage terrorism. Fortunately, he refrained from suggesting the types of legal torture that the university could use to punish me. Emergency meetings were held between President Bollinger and heads of Jewish organizations, especially the head of the ADL, as well as with editors and editorial boards of Jewish and non-Jewish newspapers. Last week, Bollinger sat down with the editorial board of the Daily News, which published the following day an editorial titled, Columbia, Fire This Professor. Nat Hentoff of the Village Voice joined the fray, as did The Nation, who, though critical of the campaign, published an article that engaged in character assassination against me. The New York Times would soon follow suit with an editorial that called for control of the content of classes at Columbia. Neoconservative alumni have also been mobilized to put pressure on the administration. These efforts, however, did not go unanswered. Defenders of academic freedom have risen to the task. Within days of the campaign, a letter with over 800 signatures from academics from around the world was sent to President Bollinger defending me and academic freedom. They were followed by hundreds of individual letters, a petition with over 3,000 signatures. Many of the letters came from my students. Many of my Jewish students wrote letters to defend me. The NYCLU wrote a letter, as did the American Association of University Professors, defending me and academic freedom against the witch hunt. So did the Academic Freedom Committee of the Middle East Studies Association and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Most of these letters were not answered. except for the NYCLU, to whom Bollinger wrote back. More recently, some of the authors of these letters received a package from Columbia assuring them that Columbia University does not have an anti-Semitism problem, and included an article from the New York Sun to prove the claim. Nothing was included in the package about the administration's efforts to defend me and the faculty against the witch hunt. In the meantime, the university convened an ad hoc committee to investigate allegations with a well-known pro-Israeli lawyer, namely Floyd Abrams, as advisor, and Ara Katzenelson, the vice president who initially met with the David Project, as chair. While the charge of the committee did not include investigating the intimidation of professors by students, other faculty, the administration, or outside forces, it could not but acknowledge the campaign to which I had been subjected. Still, even though the student claims against me had no factual basis or independent confirmation, and even though I deny that these claims are true, along with witnesses who were present in my classes, the committee found it credible in one instance that I allegedly responded to a student heatedly with harsh public criticism. The committee was most likely under much pressure exercised on it by the administration and outside forces to declare specific findings, which against logic or reasoned argument, they did. One would think that the story ends there. It does not. Even though none of the students with claims of intimidation ever reported such claims to any university channel, and the report acknowledges this, the committee found that the Columbia grievance procedure was inadequate and culpable. Why, we are not told. The administration, however, has overhauled the grievance procedure in accordance with these findings. What I have described above has not only chilled our campus with even senior tenured faculty expressing trepidation about teaching their classes, but has also ensured that junior faculty with aspirations for tenure would now be cowed into towing the party line if they want to have a future at Columbia or more generally in academia. The threat to the junior faculty is the weak link which the witch hunters are focusing on. I am merely the entry point for their political project. While the main target of the witch hunters is academic scholarship on Palestine and Israel, which they want to delegitimize fully as a scholarly endeavor in favor of accepting the official Israeli government's representation of itself as academic truth, their efforts have mushroomed into an all-out attack on the concept of academic freedom and the very institution of the university. Their threats are not limited to junior faculty, but to all classroom settings and to all scholarship. The task before us is not only to continue to insist on writing and producing scholarship about Palestine and Israel, which will continue to expose the true nature of the Israeli state and its oppressive policies, but to defend the scholarly endeavor itself, which can only be ensured if the institution of the university is maintained as a space where academic freedom is upheld. The university, with all its limitations, is one of the few remaining spaces, I would argue perhaps the only remaining one, where critical intellectuals can still live the life of the mind. What the witch hunters want us to do is to live the life of servitude to state power as technocrats and as ideologues. But we shall fight back and make sure that they do not prevail. Thank you.
We'll next hear from Tariq Ali, activist, author, playwright, filmmaker. He's longstanding editor of the New Left Review, which is nothing to sneeze at. He has written more than a dozen books on history and politics. It seems that way with the next three that is coming out, including The Clash of Fundamentalisms and Bush in Babylon. Yes, tonight he is launching three books, speaking of Empire and Resistance, a new collection of interviews with David Barsamian, published by The New Press, Street Fighting Years, an updated edition of Tariq Ali's political memoir, and A Sultan in Palermo, the fourth volume of Tariq Ali's Islamic Quintet, and an award-winning collection of historical novels. Tariq Ali is a regular contributor to publications such as The Guardian, The Independent, and the London Review of Books.
When I was listening to Joseph recounting what had been taking place in Colombia, the question that came to mind was, why? Is it the case that the United States is so dominated now by Palestinian propaganda that a balance is needed in the campuses? Is it the case that the bulk of students and the bulk of the population, when they switch on their televisions or open their newspapers, read about nothing else but pro-Palestinian articles? If that were the case, I would then understand a few people feel very strongly, getting very agitated. But the exact opposite is the case. And that is why I think one has to see what is taking place on the campus in Colombia as part of a larger and wider project which was initiated by the Sharon government soon before they went into Jenin in a big attempt to crush the Intifada. And we now know this, that a decision was taken in Israel and Israeli embassies were circulated with this, because this is not simply something that happens in the United States. We have very similar arguments emerging in every European country as well. That no criticism of Israel was to be tolerated. On television or radio, they had to make a big offensive, because after all, what they were doing could be seen. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't a secret. They were doing it in public view, so it was reported. And so the question of how it was reported and what was said about it became absolutely central to the Israeli military drive against the Palestinian resistance in Palestine during the Second Intifada. And they determined that the use of the phrase anti-Semitism must be brought up again, and critics of Sharon and the Zionist project would be labeled as anti-Semites, and it began to develop very quickly. And I remember on the BBC, a Palestinian woman had written her memoirs, Radha Karmi, which was one of the first memoirs of what it was like to be, her family were refugees who settled in Britain. And she wrote a rather moving account of what it was like growing up as a Palestinian kid in a very Jewish area of London, Golders Green. And it was quite funny as well as moving. It was impossible to get this book discussed on any BBC radio program, leave alone television. And since one knows some of these people, one said, why? Why aren't you doing this? And they said, we have very strict instructions that we can't discuss any of this unless we have someone from the other side replying. So I said, why only in this case? Why don't you have someone from the other side replying on every other question? Like when you cover Iraq. Like when you cover most of the other things this government is doing, that doesn't arise. It arrives on this because there's a very systematic campaign. And what is the debate about? It's barely a debate now because Israeli historians, including some Zionist historians like Benny Morris, have come out publicly and defended what was done in 1948 and admitted that we expelled large numbers of Palestinians, and written black on white in their history books and essays. And yes, the Israeli Defense Force, so-called, also raped Palestinian women. The exact number of the rapes is still disputed. We haven't read all the publications, But this happened. This is published by Benny Morris, leading revisionist historian. He justifies it. He says, well, we were a superior civilization. And after all, let's not forget what superior civilizations sometimes have to do. Look what the Protestants did when they took North America. They wiped out a large bulk of the Indians. He actually wrote that. So it's not a secret. It's not a big secret that these things happened. But why they will not allow an independent scholarship to assert this on Western campuses is because, given that we live today, especially today, in a world of Amnesty International and where wars are fought in the name of human rights and humanitarian interventions, to admit that this is what the Israeli government is doing every single week to Palestinians raises the question in the minds of good thinking liberal people. What to do? If this is actually going on, what are we going to do about it? And that is a question which they do not want posed at all. So discussion is curtailed, and now the space where it was possible to discuss everything, i.e. the campuses and universities, is also being curtailed. And incidentally, not simply on the question of Israel-Palestine, here we should note this, that under this neoconservative administration, which the American people in their wisdom decided to elect, in this administration does not like debates about empire, does not like debates about Iraq. The big thrust which is coming from above is interesting. It is, in a way, what they would really like. I don't think they will get away with it. But what they would really like is to impose the same balance, so-called, on campuses as they have imposed on the media. So that if you have X, who is very critical of the war in Iraq, who happens to be a professor on an American campus addressing a large body of students, then you make sure he is flanked by Y and Z, who put the administration view. This is happening now, increasingly on campuses. I mean, I've been told by a number of campuses, we would like to invite you, but we don't know who to get up against you. So I say, well, what about Fuad Ajmi? What about Kenan Makia? What about Tom Friedman? They don't want to debate, so you're caught both ways. Now, so there is a big problem of civil liberties which is coming up. And interestingly enough, we live in a period where the Cold War is over. At the time of the Cold War, in order to stress and insist on the later phase of the Cold War, not the McCarthyite phase, I talk now about the 60s and 70s and 80s, to show how democratic Western societies were, they went out of their way to permit certain things, just to show the other side what we can do and you can't do it, and that's why we are superior. But now they don't have any other side which needs to be convinced of this. So actually, the hollowing out of democracy, the whole democratic process, is something which is very noticeable, primarily in the United States, but also increasingly in many parts of Europe. That the way in which democracy as a set of rules is beginning to function is something which is basically undemocratic, if you think about it. Because how can you have alert and vigilant citizens who are capable of exercising their independent judgment when you do not have differing voices, diversity in the media, the mainstream media? That's something which we have to think about, in which the curtailment and the attack on Joseph and others brings to light the case. It highlights what is going on. That's the first point I wanted to talk about. The second point is this, that ironically enough, there is much sharper criticism of Israel inside Israel itself by a few brave people who say things which it would be virtually impossible to say in the media in this country, and which in fact is not said in the media in this country. And I just want to quote some of these things to you, because I've included them in the new introduction to Street Fighting Years. But just to show you that the mood in Europe on this question, in a country like France, very hostile to the Iraq war, but on Israel-Palestine, is not so different from here. I mean, recently, just recently, a year ago, Jean-Christophe Ruffin, who won the Prix Goncourt, the big literary prize in France, vice president of Médecins Sans Frontières, a close colleague and friend of Bernard-Henri Lévy and that whole group of intellectuals, demanded that if there should be a struggle against anti-Semitism and racism, and he told the government that radical anti-Zionism should become a punishable offense in France on a par with racist or Holocaust revisionist statements. That's how far this cancer has gone. But you don't get this from Israeli intellectuals who are opposed to what their government is doing to the Palestinians, and a handful of incredibly gifted, courageous journalists who document what goes on and who try to get to the heart of it. Amira Haas, who's traveling in the United States, is one of them. But I just want to read to you a few extracts. There's an Israeli journalist, not so well known abroad because he's never published, called Uri Blau, who conducted a set of interviews with Israeli soldiers. He identified with pseudonyms to protect them. And they were published in the Jerusalem Weekly, Kol Ha'ir. Uri Blau is the man asking the questions and the soldiers are replying. What is the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the word territories? Roy, 19, paratrooper, serving in Hebron for the past 6 months. The first thing that comes to my mind is children throwing Molotov cocktails. Basically, you should shoot them in the legs, and you don't. Tzvi, 20, serving in the Gaza Strip. My first memory is of a security patrol. You see unbelievable things there. People sitting under the bulldozers begging us not to demolish their houses. There's a guy who lives in a tent where his house stood once, and now this tent is on ground that has been annexed by the settlement. But there are stories much worse than this, real pogroms. Angry settlers coming out with sticks and pitchforks and burning down houses, just like that. Roy. In Hebron, there's basically a settler's mafia. No supervision. They can do anything they want. The police are terrified of them. When you go to arrest settlers in Hebron who've made a little pogrom, it's much more complicated than arresting an Arab fugitive. Little children throwing rocks at old Arab ladies, that's a common sight. And they throw their shit out of the windows too. Erez, 20, serving in the Nahal Brigade. My first memory is when all the riots started and we were ordered to some hilltop. Around us were some Arabs, and there were 5 trailers there, and we were a whole company on that hill. The settlers took it for granted that we were there, a whole company, defending a few trailers. They wrapped the whole world around their little finger in order to serve their ideology. Blau, do you feel something has changed in you while serving in the territories? When you go back home, do you see things differently? Dubi, 21, Golani Infantry Brigade, served in Samaria, about to finish his tour of duty. You get to a point where you're just sick of it all. They fire at us, we get there, fire on whoever fired on us, hopes it'll be over. You don't even know who supports whom, who collaborates and who doesn't. Yaron, One thing I learned in the army is that no matter how funny it sounds, it's a game. As an Israeli soldier, you have to represent this country. If you look like a jerk and do your job like a jerk, the Palestinians on the other side will see that, and people who are out to hurt you eventually will. When you stand at that checkpoint, you have to be mean, even if you feel shitty about it. You have to show them who's in charge. You can't afford to look soft. How does being on checkpoint duty change your outlook on life? Erez. These checkpoints and the fact that you can treat people this way, all of this makes a guy more confident. I mean in general, not me personally. I really didn't like treating them that way, taking part in that game, as Yaron put it. Roy. When I first got to Hebron, I wouldn't open fire on little children. And I was sure that if I ever killed or hurt anyone, I'd go so crazy that I'd leave the army. But finally, I did shoot someone and nothing happened to me. In Hebron, I shot the legs of two kids and I was sure I wouldn't be able to sleep anymore at night, but nothing happened to me. 2 weeks ago, I hurt a Palestinian policeman and that didn't affect me either. You become so apathetic, you don't care at all. Shooting is the IDF soldier's way of meditating. It's like shooting is your way of letting go of all your anger when you're in the army. In Hebron, there's this order they call punitive shooting. Just open fire on whatever you like. I opened fire not on any sources of fire, but on windows where there was just wash hanging to dry. I knew that there were people who would be hit, but at the moment it was just shoot, shoot, shoot. And it goes on for four more pages, which I've put in because it's so rare to get this. And one reason it's rare is that these Israelis and what they're saying are not being reported in the Western media. They are reported in Israeli papers sometimes, but they're not being reported in the Western media. And so you have a situation where the bulk of the population doesn't know what's going on. And all the reporting you see of Palestine, Israel, is essentially of suicide bombers, totally decontextualized from the situation that exists in that part of the world. So that all you see is a suicide bomber who appears crazy, who's taken his or her own life, and that's all. Finished. That's Palestine. And from that to say all Palestinians are terrorists is not such a big leap, because that's all that people are shown. And this is unacceptable. It's unacceptable because we know what is going on. And this obsession with stopping information from coming out to its own citizens reminds one of more authoritarian governments who did exactly the same thing in different ways. But the basic pattern is not so different. You do it in a different way, but it's the same news. How come, I ask myself often, when I'm traveling and I tend to switch from CNN to BBC World and back just to see if there's any difference now? And there isn't. And often the images they show of Iraq, of Palestine, exactly the same. The verbiage is slightly different, but the images are exactly the same. And the same images you will see on your networks. And we will see on our networks on most of Europe. And the television channels in the Arab world, which provide different images, like Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera, don't reach you. The images don't reach you. And that's a big problem for democracy and democratic functioning, where citizens can exercise their right to vote. What's the point of that right if you don't know anything? I was recently in a tiny little Arab state called Qatar. Tiny. It has two big things in it. This tiny state has the largest US military base in the world. And it has Al Jazeera television station. Not far from each other. And when I was in Qatar, it was at a conference, curiously enough, discussing history and fiction. And they asked what I would like to do. I said, I'd just like to see the U.S. base. They said, that's out of bounds. I said, okay. And then they said, then I was invited to see Al Jazeera by the director general of this television station, and I went. The young guy in his early 40s, Palestinian origin, very sharp, intelligent guy. And I was just taking notes for my own purposes, seeing him. I said, what sort of pressures are you under? He said, do you really want to know? I said, yeah. He said, from the government, none, to be honest. I said, okay. From who then? He said, last week we ran a story on our news bulletins the whole day. What was this story? He said, the story was, he said, we have 18 crews covering Iraq, 1-8, all over the country. So we get footage coming in every day. And we had this footage of a U.S. tank opening fire on a car, destroying the car, which went up, and killing everyone in it, including a husband and a wife in the front and two or three kids in the back. He said, it's an everyday story in Baghdad. But we got such clear footage that our camera guy, who was very brave, just shot it all, so we put it out. He said it went out on 3 news bulletins. And then suddenly we saw an amazing sight. The U.S. general commanding the Al Adeed military base, followed by an armored convoy, comes straight into the television station, and the general walks into the office of the head of Al Jazeera television channel. And he says, I demand an apology for that footage you've just shown. So the Al Jazeera guy says, General, we have just, what should we apologize for? For the fact that your tanks knocked out this car and killed civilians? I mean, he said, you should apologize for showing it because this breeds anti-Americanism. So the guy, very polite, very proper, said, General, what breeds anti-Americanism? The fact that we've shown it or the fact that it's happened? So, finally, finally, the general said, I insist on an apology. And the guy then became slightly angry, but still very controlled. And he said, General, you bombed our offices in Kabul when we were trying to cover the Afghan war. You killed Tariq Ayub, the head of our bureau in Baghdad, who had just arrived in Baghdad to try and report the Iraq war. You have imprisoned one of our journalists in Iraq and tortured him at Abu Ghraib prison, knowing who he was. So if anyone deserves an apology, it's us. And you're the person who should be making that apology. Now, he could say this because they were reporting the truth and what was taking place. Ugly occupation, killing civilians every single day, the tortures no longer reported in the Western media but going on. The reports come out every single day. The situation in Palestine was temporarily calm after the election of Abu Mazen because they are waiting, basically waiting for him to do something they were angry with Arafat for not doing, which is becoming launching a Palestinian civil war, saying go and crush Hamas. That's what they want Abu Mazen to do. He'll be removed if he tries to do it. There'll be a third intifada if he tries that. But that is what they're waiting for him to do. But still last week, 3 kids were killed by the IDF. Young men. And those of us who receive these regular, consistent mails each day from human rights groups in the occupied territories, and in many cases from Gush Shalom, the Israeli peace movement, who confirm it, there is now a systematic pattern of targeting, than there has been since the Second Intifada, of targeting young male Palestinians Most of them, as some of these soldiers say, are not shot in the legs, which would be what would people normally do if you want to stop someone doing something, or the arms. The bulk of them, according to medical reports, are shot in the head or shot in the eyes. That is what is going on systematically. And the Western liberal conscience has become blind to Palestinian suffering. And that can detonate crude forms of anti-Semitism, without any doubt. Not on American campuses, but on the world where this is all happening every day. But who is to blame for that? I have argued in all my novels and my other works that historically, till 1948, relations between Jews and Muslims, whether it was in Al-Andalus in Spain or in Sicily or in the Arab world, the Eastern world, were very close. They fought together. The Muslims came to their defense when they were being victimized by the Crusaders. State subsidies were given by Saladin to rebuild the synagogues in Jerusalem. So historically, these relations have been close, relatively speaking. So the notion that somehow there's a genetic anti-Semitism is nonsense, absolute nonsense. And it's no longer acceptable to use the Judeo-side of the Second World War as a permanent blackmail against anyone who wants to criticize Israel. No longer acceptable, especially when even, you know, all the stories around that are still coming out. It was a horrible crime, we all know it, but why do we have to say that every time before we criticize Israel? What has that got to do with what they are doing today? Of course, no one compares Israel to fascism as such. No one says that, except some Israeli journalists satirically do it. When the Israeli pilots refused to go and fight, very courageous, a few dozen Israeli pilots said, "We were recruited to the Israeli Air Force, not to the Mafia, to go and carry out revenge killings. We are not going to bomb Palestinian villages anymore." They were attacked, denounced, not allowed to speak at schools, not allowed to defend their case. And a very intelligent journalist, Yehuda Nuriel, who wrote a column, he had a whole page in Maarif called Nuriel's Desert, where he used to write all sorts of stuff, got so angry by the treatment of these pilots that he did what? He did something quite incredible, which no one in the West would have had the guts to do. And understandably, by the way. But he did it, Nuriel. What did he do? He went and read Hitler's Mein Kampf and Hitler's speeches denouncing dissidents, found passages from them, and reprinted it, saying, "This is a ferocious attack which has been submitted to my newspaper attacking the Israeli Air Force pilots and other dissidents by A. Schickelgruber," which was Hitler's real name. Maarif published this article. The article was reprinted in magazines till someone in Jerusalem saw it and said, "What the hell is going on?" And told the editor of Maariv, "Do you know who A. Schickelgruber is?" And then Nuriel was sacked. And he said, "I knew they'd sack me for doing this, but I had to do it, just to make the point." Now, that is courage. That is courage. And Israeli journalists, some of them, have the courage to do it inside Israel because that's where they are and they see it happening every day. If some of these little witch hunters at Columbia are really keen, that's where they should go. And go and fight on the front line. Leave Joseph alone. (Clears throat) and you'd learn much more. Here it's vicarious. What's the point of fighting here? That's where the war is going on. If that's what you want to participate in, no one's stopping you. After all, Brooklyn has supplied many veterans in the settlements. So what's the problem? Why do it here? When the bulk of the dominant culture supports you anyway. You can't even accept a few individual voices, scholarly voices. It's a pity Sarah Roy couldn't come. She's ill, but she's been writing some very good material in the London Review of Books on what's been happening at Harvard, which is similar. People being attacked, people being told to shut up. And Harvard appoints an English historian of empire, Neil Ferguson, who's a total apologist and defender of the British Empire, at a critical moment in American history and the life of the American Academy. They appoint this guy as professor of history at Harvard. Well, that's fine. I mean, you know, he's a neocon. But it did occur to me, could they not find a single American to do this job? It's the most favorable thing I've heard in defense of the American Academy, that they couldn't find an American. I guess Daniel Pipes was not considered sufficiently scholarly. But in these books, defending empire, that's not a problem. He goes and, you know, writes his spiel. Kenya was a beautiful colony under the British. The most appalling tortures went on in Kenya. The most appalling. They talk about how the United States should learn from the British Empire. They don't need to. They're a different country. They operate in a different way. But the pressure on Harvard academics is exactly the same as on Columbia academics. What else can explain the fact that one of the most unintelligible professors in Harvard, Homi Bhabha, who made after Edward Said died, in order to appease this mood and to show that even though he was a professor of literature, he was not like Edward Said. Edward's body was barely cold in the grave when Homi Bhabha came out and did an attack on him in a typically sort of sly fashion, but here there was no room for doubt. In everything else he writes, there's a lot of room for doubt because no one knows what he means. But on this particular piece, he wanted to differentiate himself from Edward Said very clearly, which he had not had the guts to do when Edward was alive. That would have been more courageous. Then we could have had a big debate about it between these two in some public forum, possibly even Columbia. But so why do they do it? Why are they on the run? Because they can't fight back. But this is a question of principle. It doesn't matter what you think about Israel or Palestine or about the Iraq war. You can support atrocities or tortures. You can do that, provided you defend the right of every other person on the campus to oppose them. Otherwise, what you're imposing is a monolithism which will destroy cultural life in this country and which will have a very bad effect on students. And I tell you something. During the last days of Eastern Europe, the last decades of Eastern Europe, when university professors were being sacked in Czechoslovakia after the Soviet invasion, lots of left and radical academics used to go to Czechoslovakia secretly, and the sacked professors and philosophers from Prague University, and set up what they called a flying university, where students could come to private houses and receive seminars. Well, if this carries on, we'll need flying universities here. Think about it. Of course, one hopes it never reaches that stage. But for it not to reach that stage, there has to be a fight back. And Joseph spoke very vigorously, but he can't be allowed to do it alone. He needs support. And the support... And the support has to come from everywhere, but mainly from within the academy. As Amy started off, academics who for a variety of reasons don't do it will find themselves under fire. That's the way this functions. They'll stand up to say something one day defending a woman's right to choose and have an abortion, and suddenly a whole pile of people come and say this is unacceptable because it challenges the fundamental tenets of our religious belief. You're oppressing us. Could happen like that. And will happen unless it's stopped. And the New York Times editorial, the editorial was a disgrace. And if they can't even respond to that editorial, the academics at Columbia, then something is seriously wrong. And the question I return to, what are you scared of? Most of you have, if not all of you, have got tenure. He's the one who's without tenure. So what are you scared of when he isn't scared? And why are you accepting to serve on bodies like these bogus investigations and inquiries in the first place? Where is it all going to end if it started so badly? So I appeal to you all. I mean, you know, this was going to be a book launch, but I said when Verso in the New Press said we have a book launch, I said it's pointless just having a book launch, launching radical books without taking up issues which are centrally important, such as the victimization at Columbia. And the fact that people see nothing wrong with young kids going in with cameras, tormenting professors, where does that come from? Ask yourself, who was taught to go and spy in classrooms and schools and colleges and universities and report back what they heard? Ask yourselves that. Where does this tradition come from? What has this tradition to do with the free functioning of democratic life in the United States or anywhere else? So I would urge you strongly not to let this issue be hidden. One has to stand up and defend the rights of people, especially people one doesn't agree with. It's very simple to defend people you agree with. It's more difficult to defend the rights of people to speak who you don't agree with. And we have never been amongst those who have said X shouldn't be allowed to speak because we don't agree with his political views. We have said, let X speak and we will debate X. Or we must have the right to answer X. And that's how debates should be conducted. So thank you.
I want to thank you all for coming and end with the words of a man from another region of the world, from South America, from Chile. Chilean author Ariel Dorfman, who narrowly escaped death on another September 11, 1973, when a last-minute change kept him from his work at the presidential palace in Santiago, where he was a cultural advisor to Chilean President Salvador Allende. Allende died that day when Chilean troops stormed the palace and Dorfman was forced into exile. On the second anniversary of the September 11th attacks in the United States, he wrote an essay, Lessons of a Catastrophe, from which this is excerpted. It can't happen here. 30 years ago, that is what we chanted, that is what we sang on the streets of Santiago de Chile. It can't happen here. There can never be a dictatorship in this country. We proclaim to the winds of history that we're about to furiously descend on us. Our democracy is too solid, our armed forces too committed to popular sovereignty, our people too much in love with freedom. But it did happen. The bombing by the Air Force of the Presidential Palace on September 11, 1973 started a dictatorship that was to last 17 years and that today, even after we've recovered democracy, continues to haunt and corrode my country. In the coming years, could something similar befall those nations with apparently stable democracies? Could the erosion of freedom that so many in Chile accepted as necessary find a perverse recurrence in the United States or India or Brazil, in France or Spain or Britain? What has transpired thus far in the 2 years since the disastrous attacks on New York and Washington is far from encouraging. We also thought, we also shouted, we also assured the planet, it cannot happen here. We also thought, on those not-so-remote streets of Santiago, that we could shut our eyes to the terrors that were awaiting us tomorrow. Thank you for coming out tonight.